Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Sitalia. Roughly 70,000 kids are in detention or correctional facilities in the U.S. Photographer and researcher Richard Ross takes us behind the barbed wire of juvenile detention with his latest work, Juvenile Injustice. The book includes evocative images and interviews with more than 1,000 juveniles and administrators in detention facilities throughout the country. We'll talk with him about juvenile justice, about the power of the still photograph, and about where he'll be focusing his camera next. Richard Ross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Patty.
Before we talk about your latest photographic project, Juvenile Injustice, I want to talk a little bit about what led you there. You were probably best known for Architecture of Authority, a photographic examination of how architectural spaces exert a kind of power over the people who are in those buildings. You did a photographic examination on museums and how art is displayed, on light, on Waiting for the End of the World, a book which was about bomb shelters in the U.S. and across the world. And these projects took you literally all around the world. How did those kinds of things lead you to examine juvenile justice through photographs?
I was used to working with architecture. Only peripherally was I working with people. The Architecture of Authority got me some recognition that I was hoping for but didn't quite expect.
A Guggenheim
was a nice
fellowship.
Thing. And some other notices and shows and just general recognition amongst a world that was pretty well spelled out in terms of my hierarchy of accomplishment. And being in Southern California, so close to LA and Hollywood, the natural instinct is to say, Son of, or the sequel. Architecture of Authority Part 2 made no sense, although I was perfectly willing to keep on exploring it. But then I looked at all the images I had of kids and spaces that kids occupied. My kids had gone through high school. They hated high school. I looked at the architecture of high school. I had looked at the architecture of the Montessori school where everybody sits on a circle. We're sitting in a circle now, which defines us as being equal. If I would be above you or you would be above me, the architecture would say something different about who's in power and who's subordinate. When the presidential candidates speak from a dais, it's to elevate them above everybody else, intellectually, in terms of authority. And then I went down to Texas and had access to some of the juvenile system there.
Your cousin works.
My cousin was a juvenile prosecutor. And he said, come look at the facilities we have. And at the end of that visit, where I photographed extensively, I said, do you ever think you'll be so successful that you'll be out of a job? And he said, not as long as the state of Texas keeps on making 10-year-olds. And I was taken aback by that. Then he said, there's no notoriety here.
Although it has a higher incarceration rate than other states.
High incarceration rate, but they're very transparent about, yes, you can come to Texas and visit and see our facilities. We know things are broken. We value you being willing to come and explore and make your findings known. Then I discovered that 22 states, including the District of Columbia, will take kids 7 years old and older into custody.
And for things that are shocking. In fact, I think in your book, you wrote about someone who stole a bagel, and someone from the facility, the detention facility, said, this child doesn't belong here.
Well, that was a great use of the photographs, where in Washoe County, a fifth grader was taken into custody. And when I went to school, there were no police in the schools. Now about 70% of institutions have school police. So they have autonomy well beyond even the normal policing authority. And when the child took something, got in a fight, fifth grader, instead of resolving the situation as you or I might, school police were brought in. They have a certain protocol. The kid had to be brought into a detention center. It was 10:30 in the morning. The mother couldn't get the fifth grader until about 6:30, single parent, when she got off work. And all of a sudden, you have a fifth grader there in a stark concrete cell, no belt, no shoes because of suicide watch. And I had to say to the kid, don't worry, your mommy will come and get you. And then the administrator said, can I have your image and show the principals and say to the principals, when you bring in the school police, this is the protocol that you invoke. This is not a place for kids. Therefore, change your procedure.
This photographic exploration took you 5 years to complete. And in fact, it's really, in a lot of ways, an ongoing process.
Hasn't stopped.
Yeah, you talked with 1,000 incarcerated youth in 31 states and visited 200 or so facilities. How difficult was access? You mentioned that it was relatively easy in Texas, and actually Pennsylvania turned out to be a welcoming state. But in general, how difficult was access?
It's all a negotiation, and my practice as an artist, people sometimes have a question about photography as art that's sort of like 1930s argument. But when they realize that most of my practice now is on the phone or on a computer, each image I take probably represents anywhere from 10 to 100 emails. So you convince people, and speaking to judges and getting MOUs,
memorandum of understanding.
And a negotiation. And then by the time I get into a facility, sit in a cell, because from the Architecture of Authority project, I've discovered that the best way to get access to a kid is to sit on the floor of an 8x10 cell and spend a half an hour with the kid above me so that they have the authority and the power to realize that I'm not the tall, old, white guy that's giving them instructions, but they're an authority above me. They can cut me off at any time.
Most were willing to talk, interested in talking.
They're teenagers. They're bored. They're drama kings and queens. They're glad somebody's paying attention to them. And I'm glad to be listening to them.
The isolation and the despair that you feel when you look at these photographs is, it really, words aren't adequate to describe that. And these are pictures of kids mostly from the back. If they aren't from the back, their faces are blurred. This is one of the things you negotiated because, of course, they're minors. Talk a little bit about, you said, the power of the photograph. What are these images doing?
Well, no matter what they describe the conditions, an administrator can make it the most beautiful room possible. They can do their best. But if you have a Four Seasons room and the door is locked, you're a prisoner, no matter what the facility is. Your liberty is taken away from you. Here I obscured the kids' faces because I wanted to generalize, you know, not only a memorandum of understanding, so that it wasn't just a caricature of that kid. You could see about the age of the kid, the gender, the race of the kid, but you could identify and you could empathize more of all the things we did when we were teenagers. Teenagers, by definition, screw up. One of the problems here is that we've criminalized normal, abnormal teenage behavior. Rather than dealing with it on a rational basis, we've created the set of procedures that criminalize, demonize, and incarcerate kids when the majority of them are being normal teenagers.
You said something that I thought was interesting about kind of the, you know, there was no more important place to be than sitting on the floor of that cell talking with someone who needed to talk. And I think a lot of us look at our own lives and, you know, if we're successful, we think, you know, that we're more brilliant or more hardworking than the next guy. And the truth is, when I look at my own life and career, I've been lucky. I've been in the right place at the right time. I was born to two stable parents in a safe zip code. And I think a lot of us forget that luck had a lot to do with it.
I am lecturing at the Palmer, and one of the slides I'm showing is a comparison between a wall of home detention in Miami, where they're sort of like scared straight graduation wall. And it's about 42 images, black and white, of mugshots of young African-American men. And it says expired on all of them. And it's not driver's licenses. They're dead. They're dead of gunshot wounds within the last 2 or 3 years. And nobody's screaming about this. And I showed that right. The subsequent slide is, I was just at the Indiana State Fair, and I photographed a wall of framed images of young white women with sashes that say Indiana State Fair Queen. And it's exactly the same formal image, but by accident of birth, these young women have opportunities that these young men, the outcome of their lives are so dramatically predetermined, it's horrific.
On a given day, how many youth are incarcerated in juvenile detention facilities across the country?
Depending on how you define detention, the statistics range anywhere from 70 to 90,000 kids per day.
At a cost of $88,000 per year per child, which is more than three times what it costs, or almost three times what it costs to incarcerate an adult.
Again, it's one of those situations of you look at the figures, in any case is great for collecting data. But I shot up at Alameda Detention Center, which is Oakland, California. They spend $224,000 per year per kid. So that's almost $250,000.
And it's $8,000 a year for a year of college.
Well, now the state of California raises tuition, and my students at UC Santa Barbara can't get into classes because so much money is spent on incarcerating kids and not enough is spent on educating kids.
How did we get into this? Why do we incarcerate youth who, according to this book and others, kids who pose relatively little risk? There are kids in there who have murdered, but most of them are in for nonviolent offenses.
Again, I'm a photographer. I am not a criminologist. I'm not a sociologist. But from what I've read, from who I've spoken to, about 12.5% of the kids that are in there may be defined as sociopaths. A lot of them have emotional and mental health needs that aren't being addressed. A lot of them come from poverty. A lot of them come from unsupervised or undersupervised homes. For a lot of them, the educational process has failed. And for example, there are a tremendous number of kids that are in there for status offenses, that they do something wrong, they're put out on probation, they violate
violation of parole.
Or probation, depends on how they're categorized. But how many kids in this country have smoked weed? And if you're out on probation or parole and it's Friday night with a bunch of your friends, do you understand the consequences of your actions? Has your prefrontal cortex developed to the level that it should have developed? I don't think so. Sometimes they're given second chances. Sometimes there are great people within the probation system that really look to the benefit of the kid and deal with diversions rather than incarcerations. But the numbers don't lie. We're spending too much money and throwing away too many lives for the wrong reasons.
Speaking of second chances, you are working at the University of California, Santa Barbara, with Victor Rios, who got a second chance. We're talking about someone who grew up in abject poverty in California. He came here from Mexico. He tells a story about an infant cousin who his face was literally being eaten by a rat, and he required extensive surgery to correct that. Someone who was a gang member and a teacher along the way, after a good friend of his was killed, asked him how he was and basically said, "I'm here when you're ready to make a change." And he went on to earn a PhD, and he works with you and your wife on this book has become a class. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's great. I mean, we have a multidisciplinary program at UC Santa Barbara. So Victor, my wife Sissy, and I got together and we said we can do this sort of under the radar. And we all met and sort of like exchanged notes in classes. And rather than changing how courses were structured, we scheduled things at the same time. And we all would interject each other into each other's classes and open up office hours for each other's students.
So kids are writing about juvenile justice, for example, and Rios is a sociologist.
He's teaching them methodology. My wife, Sissy's teaching them academic writing and journalism. I'm teaching them photography. And we're all teaching them how to care, get involved, and have a voice in the procedure. And then we brought in all speakers. Everybody was behind getting this program going, and it's become something.
And in fact, you credit Bart Lubow with changing your anger at what you saw into effective advocacy.
He's very soft-spoken, he's very well-mannered, and he's taught me that I have a limited number of battles I can fight. I have to figure out the energy versus the reward and figure out where I can apply my work, where I can gather the research I'm doing, and where I have to avoid it.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. In his latest work, renowned photographer and researcher Richard Ross opens our eyes to the harsh realities of America's juvenile justice system. For his book, Juvenile Injustice, Ross photographed and interviewed more than 1,000 youths over a 5-year period in juvenile detention facilities around the country. The result is powerful and haunting.
One of the proudest moments as a result of this photographic exploration is a Senate subcommittee used your images as part of a discussion on federal legislation to prevent pretrial juveniles, kids who have been detained but they have not yet been to trial, from being housed with kids who have committed serious crimes. And you said, it's great to know that your work, quote, was being used for advocacy rather than the masturbatory art world I grew up in.
You can say that? My world had a certain hierarchy of the exhibitions at the major museums, the books being recognized by certain people. That was what I grew up in. That was what I felt I was pleasing my parents, who were long gone, with the expectations of what a project should be in terms of being celebrated or recognized. And now, being able to write a letter to a judge in Miami regarding a kid that's been held for 4 years and 4 months without a trial, in spite of the Sixth Amendment, and knowing that that judge feels that he's a little under scrutiny of a broader public with his actions, gives me a degree of satisfaction. Knowing that the work that the Supreme Court ruled that kids under 16 cannot be sentenced to life without parole, maybe my work had some tiny bit of moving things along. Statistics are critical, legal briefs are critical, but then you look at these kids' faces, blurred or not, and you know that there are lives at stake here. It's a great feeling.
In fact, each photograph in this book, and there are about 150 of them, have a little story. There's one that I really can't shake. It's a young man reclining on a cot, and he's holding a piece of paper with his personal timeline. And it's literally one disaster after another from the day he was born. Abusive parents, drug-addicted mother, stepfathers who beat him. You know, there are some who talk about being electrocuted, hands burned, young girls, all of them in one facility that you visited in Rosemead, California. Every one of them had been sexually abused prior to their incarceration.
I asked the director of that institution what percentage, and he said every one. And it floored me. And then he turned around and said, most of the boys are physically, mentally, and sexually abused as well. So you look at these kids as being horrendous. We went through the 90s with the concept of super predators, and very few people have stopped and really looked at these kids as victims, not only of their environment, but of the system, of society as well, and figure out how to be restorative to these kids instead of being biblical and dealing with retribution against these kids.
And with what effect? One of the things that Bart Lebo says is the real tragedy is that it's unnecessary and ineffective, that the longer these kids are incarcerated, the more likely the recidivism rate is to go up.
Every kid screws up. That's the definition of a teenager. You have to screw up. If you're a kid of color, the chances of you being brought into a system that's harsh or penalizing is so disproportional to general society. When a kid crosses that threshold of any sort of detention system where they are a prisoner, whether they're convicted or pre-adjudicated, their chances of succeeding in life fall about 50% of on the other side of the threshold. So you talk about kids that are on the deep end of the system that may become so deeply involved that they become institutionalized, that it's really difficult to save them, but it's still lives at stake. And then probably 80% of them, for one reason or another, if you think they're kids that have their toes touching the water and can be diverted into useful lives if given the right resources. And I'm trying to give evidence as to who these kids are and allow policymakers to use images to frame the conversation, to change the way policy is now, but also going around to places like Penn State and trying to influence another generation. So it's multifold in my strategy here.
You mentioned race a moment ago, and there are some photographs where everyone featured is Black or Hispanic. What did you see going around the country and looking at these juvenile detention facilities?
A lot of faces of color, a lot of kids that come from backgrounds of privation, and you go into this thinking, well, a lot of these kids deserve to be there. It's not true. A lot of these kids are not affiliated as gang members. The minority are the hardcore. But they talk about their lives. We talked previously about, you know, the two-year-old, the unsupervised, the 12-year-old mother, babies having babies, the grandparents raising a generation. The one kid in Florida has been there 4.5 years. His mother was a 30-year crack addict. He hasn't been to trial yet. There is a Sixth Amendment in this country, but these are kids.
I'm guaranteeing everyone a speedy trial, but there isn't a ruckus if it's a teenager who is waiting 4 years for a trial?
I sit there and I talk to kids that have no voice, from families that have no resources, from neighborhoods that have no power. And they're the far end of the spectrum that something happens to my kid, I'm going to be there, not tomorrow, I'm going to be there within the hour to advocate and pay attention to them and make sure they're not in this system. But these kids, they don't have somebody speaking for them. So when I turned around and did this blog, which I, this is my world now, and tweet and Facebook, it became important to use the first person narrative so that their voices could be heard really directly instead of me describing them as he said or she said. I'm using their voice to come forward.
One of the things that that Bart
Lubow,
writes in your book in the foreword is that the tide is finally changing, that in recent decades there's been a dramatic reduction in youth incarceration. And I'm wondering, for those who think we should be locking all of these kids up, what impact has that had, the reduction on public safety?
It hasn't increased crime. So you can look at charts, which are very complicated to look at, which is why I'm doing photographs, to supplement complicated data. And as states have increased incarceration of kids, the crime rate has gone down. As states have decreased the incarceration of kids, the crime rate has gone down as well. So there's no correlation between locking up kids and increasing public safety. It doesn't exist. And there's clear, hard, empirical data that it's not effective in terms of helping society, and it's wasting resources.
You said once also, I respect artists that deal with surface, texture, shape, form, and concept, but my heart lies with people who try to change the world and feel they can have a difference in making people think differently. Do you remember the moment that your focus, your passion changed?
It's been a series of moments, but it's my most satisfying moments now, with a bad back and all, sitting in a jail cell in Miami, for example, which is way too cold, concrete, and just spending 3 or 4 hours with a kid, one kid, another kid, and listening to their story. And I just think, I could be the normal average American sitting there on a Sunday or a Monday watching TV, watching a football game with friends, but I'm in Miami and I'm listening to this kid tell me what his life is and asking him about his father, his mother, Boo, his brother, this guy, that guy. And it's so unbelievably rewarding that as I'm doing it, I just think I'm so privileged. It's amazing. I don't know how I got here, but I'm so grateful to be in this cell.
And you feel a responsibility to do something with that
how
experience.
How do you not? You have to share this. You have to. I've spent a lifetime in like museums showing the world attics and basements that they can't get to bomb shelters, trying to explore a world of people that are survivalists or fear the ultimate apocalypse. And it's always been trying to gather information that's been not available. And here I am in the mother lode of it.
What can people who see your photographs, what can they do if they're moved, in many cases perhaps to tears, by what they see? How can you make a difference here?
You can take action. On the website that I'm doing, there's a section that says take action. And it gives a list of where people in Pennsylvania and any of the surrounding areas here, how they can interact and how they can become advocates, how they can go into a detention center, how they can become a big brother or big sister to kids before kids get in there. There's any number of things you can do, but you have to get up off your ass and do it. You can't just press like or share.
Good point. Now, this book is an incredible book, and yet it's self-published.
Yep.
Despite your publishing history track record, you weren't able to get a publisher for this one.
It's a different world in terms of publications, and I respect publishers trying to keep the doors open. But this was too difficult for them to publish. But it was critical to be published. I had everything together. I had done earlier books. And then I spoke to Bart Lubow, and I said, I can't get this book published. And he said, I'll pre-order 500 copies of the book, which paid for the printing of the book. Now I have a couple of extra that people can go to. May I? juvenile-in-justice.com, and they can order the book, or they can go to amazon.com and order the book, $29.95. Great essay by Ira Glass, great essay by Bart Lubow, and really engages you in this. And a pretty good afterword by me.
By you. And in fact, it's interesting because Ira Glass's essay is about meeting with a 15-year-old girl who was in a juvenile detention facility because she killed a young boy. She and some other girls enticed some boys into a bathroom thinking they were going to get sex and shot them in the head. And Ira Glass was blown away by the fact that the young girl he talked to wasn't sullen or didn't seem sociopathic. She seemed remarkably normal.
Normal and proud. Glass has always been really interested in juveniles in the system. There's a subtext that goes through a lot of his very entertaining This American Life. There's pulses of drug court, of kids within the system, of kids that have screwed up, of the bullying in middle schools. It's a constant thread. So when I heard drug court, and then I sent him a note congratulating him and said, would you do an introduction? At first he was reticent to take on more homework, but then he got behind it completely and has been a big help in doing this book.
And Bart Lubow was a little perplexed by that essay and actually by your afterword, because he said it perpetuated the stereotype in a way that the kids in these facilities are violent when the vast majority actually aren't. That 15-year-old who blew a young boy's brains out was the anomaly, not the average kid in juvenile detention.
Well, then I had to negotiate and edit between different competing philosophies of different lenses that we were all looking through. When you hear This American Life, I defy you to turn it off, because it's always a compelling story. And in order to have that story, you need that hook in it, and you need to go to that 12% rather than the 87% and say most of these kids are relatively normal. You need the anomaly. So it's multiple competing and sympathetic points of view that we're all trying to deal with in this discussion about kids.
All right, Richard Ross, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure being here.
That was photographer and researcher Richard Ross, a distinguished professor of art at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Juvenile Injustice. His work has been exhibited in museums worldwide. To learn more, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.